The Mystery and Romance of Alchemy and Pharmacy by C.J. S. Thompson. Read by Graham Dunlop. Edited by Darren Grimes. Preface. It has been my endeavor in the following pages to sketch, however imperfectly, some phases of the romance and mystery that have surrounded the arts of medicine, alchemy, and pharmacy, from the earliest periods of which we have record down to the close of the 18th century. The influence of the past on the present is greater than we commonly suppose. In this age of rapid scientific progress and brilliant research, we are apt to overlook and lose sight of the patient labors of the early pioneers of science, many of whom laid the foundations of discoveries that have since proved of inestimable value to mankind. Hence, the history of the past, whether in science or in art, is always worthy of study and attention. My thanks are due to the editor of the Pharmaceutical Journal for permission to reproduce several illustrations which appeared in its pages together with a portion of this work. CJST, Liverpool, 1897. Chapter 1. The Dawn of the Art of Healing. The foundation of the art of healing, the most ancient record of medicine and pharmacy, the Ebers Papyrus, origin of the term pharmacist, drugs used in ancient Egypt, early Jewish medicines, the antiquity of medicine and alchemy in China, the Chinese and the Philosopher's Stone, ancient Chinese materia medica, the medical art in ancient Greece, the Grecian temples of medicine, methods of treatment, the Oath of Hippocrates. The birth of the art of healing goes back to a period of great antiquity. The instinct that first led man to utilize the fruits of the earth for his bodily sustenance may perchance have suggested the herbs which grew around him as a means of alleviating the ills of his flesh. It is a matter of doubt whether medicine as an art was first practiced in Egypt or China. From recent research, probably the former, as at the time of the writing of the Ebers Papyrus, B.C. 1550, the Egyptians had a considerable knowledge of the use of herbs and other bodies for medicinal purposes. The art of medicine had two foundations: empiricism and superstition, which have influenced it from its birth down to the present time. The most ancient record of medicine and pharmacy known was discovered at Kahun in 1889, near the pyramid of Illahun and the ruins of an ancient town, which had apparently been inhabited by the builders of the pyramid. It dates from the 12th dynasty, B.C. 2700 to 2500, more than 1,000 years before the Exodus. Besides containing instructions for midwives, it includes numerous formulae for the treatment of various complaints, composed of such very homely articles as beer, cow's milk, honey, oil, onions, herbs, dates, and other fruits. The Ebers Papyrus, which was found reposing between the legs of a mummy, throws a light on ancient Egyptian pharmacy, and was written in the reign of King Amenhotep I of the 18th dynasty. It commences as follows. Beginning of the chapter of applying medicaments to every part of the patient. I have come forth from Heliopolis with the mighty ones of the Temple of the Sun, the wielders of protection, the princes of eternity. Rescuing, I come forth from Sais with the mothers of the gods who have given me their protection. I have magic formula made by the universal Lord to drive out the stroke of God and goddess, the male death and female death, etc. That is in this my head, in this my neck, in this my shoulder, in this my flesh, in these my limbs, to punish the above-named enchanters, who introduce disturbance into this my flesh. Such formula, evidently for recitation during the treatment, continued for a page and a half. The book has thus no general title, but plunges at once into the mysteries of the profession. Beginning of the mystery of the physician who knows the motion of the heart, there are vessels in it to every limb, When any physician, doctor, or amulet maker puts his finger upon the top of the head, upon the occiput, upon the hands, upon the chest, upon the arms, upon the legs, he communicates with the heart. For its vessels extend to every limb, wherefore it is called the starting point of every limb. The following may be taken as an example of the recipes given in the manuscript. A remedy for the belly that is painful. Cumin, 1/64 hin. Goose grease, 1/8 hin. Milk, 1/16 hect. Cool, strain, and drink. The hin is about 29 cubic inches, and the 1/16 hect, 18 cubic inches. The prescription is thus roundly 1/2 cubic inch of cumin and 4 of goose fat and 1/2 a pint of milk. This papyrus contains 110 pages, each page consisting of about 22 lines of bold hieratic writing. It may be described as an encyclopedia of medicine as known and practiced by the Egyptians of the 18th dynasty, and it contains prescriptions of all kinds of diseases, some borrowed from Syrian medical lore, and some of such great antiquity that they are ascribed to the mythological ages, when the gods yet reigned personally on earth. Among others is given the recipe for an application whereby Osiris cured Ra of a headache. In this papyrus is an example of an old Egyptian diagnosis and therapeutics as follows. When thou findest anyone with a hardness in his rehit, pit of the stomach, and when, after eating, he feels a pressure on his intestines, his hit is swollen, and he feels bad in walking like one who suffers from heat in his back, then observe him when he lies stretched out, and if thou findest his intestines hot and a hardness in his rehit, say unto thyself, this is a disease of the liver. Then prepare for thyself according to the secrets of the science from the plant, pakka, test, and dates, mix them, and give in water. It also contains numerous recipes for the treatment of diseases, for internal and external use. Most of the drugs mentioned are derived from indigenous plants and such chemical bodies as alum, salt, nitre, and sulfate of copper are included in some of the prescriptions. It seems probable that most of the medicines used in this early times were first tried as foods, and those which, when taken in large quantities or in special conditions, influenced the functions of the body. These and others found to be too strong for dietetic use were regulated to the books of medicine. As an instance of this, the leaves and seeds of the castor oil plant and the astringent sycamore fig are included in many recipes. But Maspero states that there is little doubt that castor oil was taken regularly in food in the time of the pharaohs, and at the present time it is a favorite adjunct to the salads of the Egyptian Farline. The same writer thinks the Egyptians began by eating every kind of food which the country produced, and so became acquainted with their therapeutic properties. In another papyrus, said to have been written about the same time of King Chata of the first dynasty, who reigned B.C. 4000, the following prescription for promoting the growth of the hair is given: pad of a dog's foot, fruit of a date palm, ass's hoof, boil together in oil. Dr. V. Ophil states of pharmacy before the time of Hippocrates that, although the practice of medicine was not separated from pharmacy among the Greeks and Romans, there was such a separation among the ancient Egyptians, from whom the distinction was handed down to the Copts, and by them to the Arabians, and, in fact, that the term pharmacist is probably of Egyptian origin, being derived from pharmaki, which signifies the preparation of medicine from drugs. The Egyptian pharmaki, who were engaged in that occupation, belonged to the higher social ranks of writers or academically educated persons, comprising also the priests, physicians, statesmen, and military commanders. The Jews were indebted to Egypt for their primary ideas of medicine, but they cast away the ideas of demonology and magic which clouded what was good in the practice of Egypt. The Talmud recommends onions for worms and wine, pepper, asafoetida, for flatulency. The Talmudists are responsible for calling the earth, air, fire, and water elementary bodies. In the Middle Ages, the Jews rendered service to the healing art and had a large share in the scientific work connected with the Arab domination of Spain. In China, the use of drugs goes back to a very remote age, and alchemy was practiced by the Chinese long previous to its being known in Europe. For two centuries prior to the Christian era, and for four or more subsequent, the transmutation of the base metals into gold and the composition of the elixir of immortality were questions ardently studied by the Chinese. It is, moreover, a matter of history that intercourse between China and Persia was frequent both before and after the Mohammedan conquest of the latter country, that embassies from Persia, as well as from the Arabs, and even from the Greeks in Constantinople, visited the court of the Chinese emperor in Shanxi, that Arab traders settled in China, and that there was frequent intercourse by sea between China and the Persian Gulf. And lastly, that China had an extensive alchemical literature anterior to the period when alchemy was studied in the West. All these facts go to prove that the ancient science known as alchemy was originated by the Chinese, and not by the disciples of Muhammad, who only acquired the knowledge at second hand. It is somewhat curious that while the alchemists of the West were always in doubt as to what constituted the true philosopher's stone, the Chinese seemingly had no doubt as to its identity. Cinnabar was regarded by the early alchemists and philosophers of that nation as the wonderful body which was supposed to have the mysterious power of converting other metals into gold, and when used as a medicine would prolong life for an indefinite period. Ko Hung, author of the Paoputzi Pian, a work of the 4th century and undoubtedly genuine, gives various mineral and vegetable productions possessing in different degrees the properties of an elixir vitae. In one paragraph of this work, he states, "When vegetable matter is burnt, it is destroyed, but when the ayan sha, cinnabar, is subjected to heat, it produces mercury. After passing through other changes, it returns to its original form. It differs widely, therefore, from vegetable substances, and hence it has the power of making men live forever and raising them to the rank of the genie. He who knows the doctrine, is he not far above common men, etc.?" In Materia Medica, the knowledge of the Chinese was much in advance of the nations of the West, and their great herbal entitled Punisaun Kang Mu, written by Li Shi Qin in the middle of the 16th century, shows the discernment possessed by these curious people. This work consists of 40 thin octavo volumes, the first three of which contain woodcuts of many of the minerals, plants, and animals referred to in the text. The woodcuts alone number 1,100, and the work itself is divided into 52 divisions. The antiquity of the practice of medicine among the Chinese may be gathered from the fact that there exists a work entitled A Treatise from the Heart of the Smallpox, which was written during the dynasty of Ichion BC 1122. In this work, the eruption is described and some kind of inoculation is also referred to as a remedy. But it is to Greece that we have to look for the birth of medical art in the West, its practice by the priests being of great antiquity. The earliest record of a temple of medicine is of one erected in the Peloponnese in the year BC 1130, or about 50 years after the fall of Troy. Other temples or centers of the healing art gradually sprang up, and round each of those clustered a little school of students. There were the Temple of Health at Pergamus, the Temple of Hygieia at Sitia, and the temples of Asclepius at Kos and Epidamnus, where the famous statue of Asclepius stood. The father of ancient medicine, Hippocrates, graduated as a student of Kos, and Galen is said to have been at Epidamnus. It was in the temple of Asclepius at Greece that any record of medicine was first kept, the names of diseases and their cures being registered on tablets of marble. The priests and priestesses, who were the guardians of the temple, prepared the remedies and directed their application, and thus commenced the practice of physic as a regular profession. These official persons were ambitious to pass as the legitimate descendants of Asclepius, and therefore assumed the title of the Asclepiades. The writings of Pausanias, Plutarch, and others abound with accounts of the artifices of these early practitioners. Aristophanes mentions the dexterity and promptitude with which they collected and put into their bags the offerings on the altar. The patients were wont to repose on the skins of sacrificed rams in order to procure celestial visions. As soon as they were supposed to be asleep, a priest, clothed in the dress of Asclepius, imitating his manner and accompanied by the daughters of the god, that is, the young actresses well up in their parts, entered and solemnly delivered a medical opinion. The student sat at the feet of the philosopher of his choice, and after a certain period and course of probation, was granted the rights of priest and physician to practice as a teacher and healer. They had their code and ethics of a standard almost equal to those of today, and their knowledge of surgery and the use of the herbs and plants which grew around them was not a little. Entering on their novitiate at their chosen temple or school, they were required to make a protestation or oath, of which the following is the one made by Hippocrates. I, Hippocrates, do now promise and protest to the great god Apollo and his two daughters, Hygieia and Panadai, and also to all the gods and goddesses, to observe the contents of this oath or tables wherein the oath is carved, written, or engraved, so far as I can possibly, and so far as my wit or understanding shall be able to direct me. These, I yield myself, tributary and debtor to the master and doctor, who hath instructed me and showed me this science and doctrine, even as much or rather more than to my father who hath begotten me, and that I shall live and communicate with him and follow him in all necessities which I shall know him to have, so far as my power shall permit and my goods extend. Also that I shall love and cherish his children as my brothers and his progeny as my own. Further, that I shall teach, show, and demonstrate the said science without reward or covenant, and that I shall give all the canons, rules, and precepts freely, truly, and faithfully to my master, his children as to my own, without hiding or enacting anything, and to all other scholars who shall make the same oath or protestation, and to no others. Also that in practicing and using my science towards the sick, I shall use only things necessary so far as I am able, and as my spirit and good understanding shall give unto me, and that I shall cure the sick as speedily as I may without dilating or prolonging the malady, and that I shall not do anything against equity for hatred, anger, envy, or malice to any person whatsoever. Moreover, that I shall minister no poison, neither counsel nor teach poison, nor the composing thereof to any. Also that I shall not give nor cause to be given, nor contend that anything be applied to a woman breeding, to destroy and make her void her fruit. But I shall protest to keep my life and science purely, sincerely, and inviolably, without deceit, fraud, or guile, and that I shall not cut or incise any person having the stone, but shall leave the same to those who are expert in it. And furthermore, that I shall not enter into the patient's house lest with purpose to heal him, and that I shall patiently sustain the injuries, reproaches, and loathsomeness of sick men and other base railings, and that I shall eschew, as far as I may, all venerous lasciviousness. Moreover, I protest, be it man, woman, or servant, who is my patient, to cure them of all things, that I may see or hear either in mind or manner, and I shall not betray that which should be concealed or hidden, but keep inviolable with silence, neither reveal any creature under pain of death. And therefore I beseech our gods that observing this protestation, promise, and vow entirely and inviolably, all things in my life, in my art and science, may succeed securely, healthfully, and prosperously to me, and in the end eternal glory. And to him that shall violate, transgress, or become perjured, that the contrary may happen unto him, viz. Misery, calamities, and continual maladies, We have here principles laid down which would do honor to any medical body, and which show the highly civilized condition and the excellent moral teaching of the early Greek philosophers and priests. Chapter 2. The Wizards of Early Greece. Tiresias, Abaris, Pythagoras, Epimenides, Empedocles, Aristras, Hermodimus. One of the earliest magicians or soothsayers of which we have record out of the era of mythology was Tiresias. He lived in the times of Oedipus and the War of the Seven Chiefs against Thebes. For having offended the gods, he was visited with blindness, but being repentant, tradition states they recompensed him for this affliction by endowing him with the gift of prophecy and the act of divination. He is also said to have been able to hold communion with the feathered world, and to have power over the spirits of the dead, whom he could compel to appear and reply to his inquiries. His incantations and spells were supposed to be irresistible, and he could foretell future events by signs from fire, smoke, and other methods of divining. Abaris, a native of Scythia, was another magician of renown. There's no exact record of the time which he lived, but he is represented by some as having constructed the Palladium, which protected Troy from its enemies for a long time. Other authors declare that he was a friend of Pythagoras, who flourished some 600 years later. According to Herodotus, he traveled over the world with an arrow, eating nothing during his journey. By others, it is said that the arrow was presented to him by Apollo, and that upon it he rode through the air and traveled over lands, seas, mountains, and other inaccessible places. But from all accounts, his repute as a magician and seer is confirmed. He is said to have foretold earthquakes, allayed storms and pestilence, cured disease by charms and incantations, and was generally revered for his power and command over the dwellers in the unseen world. Pythagoras, one of the most notable magicians in early history, was born about the year BC 586 and lived during the time of Cyrus and Darius Hystaspes, of Croesus, Pisistratus, of Polycrates, and Amasis, king of Egypt. He was renowned not only as a philosopher, but as a leader and politician, and was learned in all branches of science then known. The early part of his life was spent in Egypt, but he also traveled in order to gather experience and knowledge until he reached the age of 40 years. Afterwards, he founded a school where he lectured and instructed a large number of followers who were attracted by his wisdom and learning. He divided his pupils into two classes, the neophytes, to whom were explained the elementary and general principles of his philosophy, while the advanced were admitted into his entire confidence and formed a brotherhood, who threw their property into a common stock and lived together. During the latter part of his life, he is said to have lived in Magna Graecia, where he carried on his studies and made some of his great discoveries. He was a profound geometrician, and two great theorems, one still known as the Pythagorean, are ascribed to him. He propounded the doctrine that the earth is a planet of spherical form, and the sun the center of the planetary system. His philosophy prescribed and taught a total abstinence from everything which had animal life and temperance in all things, together with the subjection of the appetites of the body. By this strict discipline, he seems to have obtained almost complete control over the wills and minds of his followers, from whom he demanded the utmost docility. Preparatory to entering on his novitiate, the pupil was strictly examined by the master as to his principles, habits, and intentions. The tone of his voice, his manner of speaking, his walk, gestures, and the lines of his face and the expression of his eyes were all carefully observed, and only if all these features were satisfactory was he admitted as a probationer. After this interview, the master withdrew from the sight of the pupil, who could then enter on his novitiate of 3 and 5 in all 8 years, during which time he was not permitted to look on the master, but only hear him speak from behind a curtain, and he was enjoined to preserve the strictest silence. To add to his mystery and authority, Pythagoras is said to have hid himself during the day from his pupils, and was only visible to them after the night had come on. He is described as having a most imposing and majestic appearance, with a grave and awe-inspiring countenance. When he came forth, he appeared in a long garment of the purest white, with his long beard flowing and a garland upon his head. He allowed his followers to believe he was one of the gods, and he is said to have told Iberus that he resumed human form so that he might win the confidence of man. Doubtless, owing to his great attainments and his superiority up to the men of his time, he considered himself more divine than human, and he claimed to have miraculous endowments. Those who were not of his followers ascribed the stories related of him to magic, which probably, like other philosophers, he studied. Among other stories which tradition has handed down concerning Pythagoras are the following. He professed to have appeared in different ages in various human forms, first as Athalides, the son of Mercury, and then as Euphorbu, who slew Patroclus at the siege of Troy, and as other individuals also. He is said to have tamed a bear by whispering in its ear and prevailed on it to feed on vegetables alone. He called also an eagle down from its flight, causing it to sit on his hand as if quite tame. When Iberus addressed him as one of the heavenly host, he convinced him that he was indeed a celestial being by showing him his thigh of gold, which also he exhibited to skeptical pupils. At another period, he absented himself from his associates in Italy for a year. When he reappeared, he stated that he had been sojourning in the infernal regions and gave them wonderful descriptions of the strange things he had seen there. These and many other fabulous stories are related of this singular man, which prove him to have been as wily as he was wise. One curious rule by which he bound his pupils is worth mentioning. At the end of their novitiate, if it was discovered that their intellectual faculties were too weak to grapple with the intricacies of his theories and problems, they were expelled the community. The double of the property they had contributed to the common stock was refunded to them. A monument inscribed with their names was placed in the meeting place of the community, and they were considered as dead by the brotherhood. It is easy to imagine with what feelings these measures would be regarded by some who were called to submit to them, and so they eventually proved the cause of the breakup of the Pythagorean school. Cylon, a man of great wealth of Cretona, conceived a great partiality for Pythagoras and became a novice with Perialis and submitted to all the severities of the school. They passed through the 3 years of probation and 5 years of silence and were received into the familiarity of the master. But after they had delivered their wealth into the common stock, Pythagoras pronounced them to be deficient in intellectual power, or for some other reason, most probably, they were expelled. A tablet inscribed with their names was set up, and they were pronounced dead to the school. Cylon, who was a man of excitable and violent temperament, became highly incensed at this treatment and resolved on vengeance. Collecting a band of followers, which probably included a large number of rejected students, they surrounded the school of the master and set it on fire. 40 people are said to have perished in the flames, but Pythagoras, with 2 of his pupils, escaped to Metapontum, where he took refuge in the Temple of the Muses. The strife fomented by Cylon broke out afresh, and he was closely besieged in the temple by his enemies. The rioting continued, and as no provisions could be conveyed to him, he finally perished with hunger, according to Laretius, after 40 days' abstinence. Thus ended Pythagoras, a man of undoubted genius and in knowledge much in advance of his time. Although his teachings were mixed up with considerable artifice and deception, he ranks as one of the greatest of the Greek philosophers. Epimenides was a native of Crete and probably lived before the time of Pythagoras. He was credited with marvelous performances from a very early age, and it is said, when quite a lad, to have retired to a cave and slept for 57 years. He then returned to his father's house, which he found in the possession of a new tenant, and the family disappeared. At length, he came across his brother, who had grown into an old man, who after some time acknowledged him. On this story becoming known, he was accounted a favorite of the gods, and he professed to be endowed with supernatural gifts. He made it known that he was supplied with food by the nymphs, and that he was exempt from the usual necessities imposed on the body by nature. He boasted that he could separate his soul from his body and recall it as he thought fit. He professed to have dealings with the unseen world, and would exorcise evil spirits or work spells. He had great renown as a seer, and his prophecies were regarded as direct messages from the gods. But the great act of his life was his delivery of Athens from a great pestilence after the rebellion of Ceylon. The plague, which had almost decimated the city, could not be stopped, and the Athenian Senate, after much deliberation, resolved to send for Epimenides, who was at that time in Crete. A special vessel was placed under the command of one of the first citizens of the state, who was commissioned to bring the wise magician. On his arrival at Athens, he at once set to work with solemn rites and ceremonials. He commanded that a number of black and white sheep should be led to the Areopagus, then be let loose and allowed to wander whither they wished. Certain persons were instructed to follow them and mark the spot where they lay down, on which place the animal was sacrificed to the local deity. In this manner, it is recorded, the plague was stayed. According to some writers, he also sacrificed human victims. Although pressed by the Athenian state to take a recompense for his services, Epimenides is said to have refused all gifts, stipulating only that there should be perpetual peace between the Athenians and the people of Knossos, his native city. He died shortly afterwards at the reputed age of 157 years. Empedocles was a distinguished magician, orator, and poet, and was born in Agrigentum, Sicily. He was a follower of Pythagoras and probably received instruction from his successors. He was credited with miraculous powers and to have been able to restore the dead to life. He was skilled in medicine and the use of herbs, and was indeed a general benefactor to the citizens of his native place, where he was almost worshipped as a god. Like other philosophers of his time, he was inordinately vain, but was undoubtedly a man of great intelligence, and conferred immense benefits on his fellow creatures. His belief in the power of magic is shown in the following words he was wont to address to his students. "By my instructions you shall learn medicines that are powerful to cure disease and reanimate old age. You shall be able to calm the savage winds which lay waste the labors of all the husbandmen. And when you will, shall send forth the tempest again. You shall cause the skies to be fair and serene, or once more shall draw down refreshing showers, reanimating the fruits of the earth. Nay, you shall recall the strength of the dead man when he was already become the victim of Pluto." Of himself, he said, "I mix with you a god, no longer a mortal, and am everywhere honored by you, as is just. Crowned with fillets and fragrant garlands, adorned with which, when I visit populous cities, I am revered both by men and women, who follow me by 10,000s, inquiring the road to boundless wealth, seeking the gift of prophecy, and who would learn the marvelous skill to cure all kinds of diseases." Of other wizards of early Greece, Herodotus mentions Erystras, a poet of Prosenesis, who is said to have mysteriously disappeared from the earth for 340 years, and then appeared again at Metapontum and commanded the citizens to erect a statue to him. Also, Hermodimus, who was reputed to have the power of separating his soul from his body at will. But little is known beyond the merest tradition of these worthies. Chapter 3. The Wizards of the Roman Empire. A Roman sorceress, Virgil's sorceress. Canidia, a witch's incantation. The Roman philosophers, like the Greeks, claimed to possess occult powers, and the practitioners of magic and sorcery were numerous during the time of the empire. We have a graphic description of the incantations of a Roman sorceress in the story of Dido. Deserted by Aeneas, she resolves on self-destruction. To delude her sister as to her secret purpose, she sends for a priestess from the gardens of the Hesperides, pretending that her object is to effect the return of her lover by means of certain magical incantations. The priestess, who is invested with magical powers, can call up the spirits of the dead, cause the solid earth to rock and quake, and the trees of the forest to descend from the mountains. On the arrival of the sorceress, she commands that a funeral pyre shall be erected in the interior court of the palace, and that the arms of Aeneas, what remains of his attire, and the marriage bed in which Dido had received him, shall be placed upon it. The pyre is to be hung round with garlands and branches of cypress, and the whole crowned with a picture of Aeneas and his sword. Altars were placed around, and the priestess, with disheveled hair, cried aloud with terrible charms upon her 300 gods, upon Erebus, Chaos, and the three-faced Hecate. The waters of Avernus were then sprinkled about, and certain magical herbs that had been cut by moonlight with a sickle of brass. The priestess had with her the excrescence, which is found upon the forehead of a new-cast foal, the size of a dried fig, a talisman of great power. Dido is then called upon to approach, and with her robe drawn up, exposing one bare foot, she makes the circle of the altars, embracing them successively, and breaks over each a consecrated cake. The pyre is lit, and the charm is supposed to be complete. But all the power and the elaborate ritual prescribed by the sorceress were of no avail. Aeneas returns not, and the broken-hearted Dido finally stabs herself and dies. Many prodigies are interspersed throughout the early history of Rome, and most of the acts of these people were surrounded with a halo of superstition natural at the time, and doubtless largely exaggerated. Virgil, Horace, Ovid, and Lucian all allude to the belief in and the practice of sorcery and magic by the Romans. In the 8th eclogue of Virgil, we have a detailed description of a Roman sorceress. She is introduced by the poet as giving directions to her assistant as to the working of certain charms. Her object, a common one apparently at that time, is to recall Daphnes, whom she calls her husband, to return once more to her arms. The assistance is directed to burn vervain and frankincense, and the highest efficacy is ascribed to a solemn chant, which is capable of calling down the moon from its sphere or making the cold-blooded snake burst in the field, and was the means by which Circe turned the companions of Ulysses into beasts. The image of Daphnes is then ordered to be thrice bound round with fillets of three colors, the assistants at the time repeating the words, "Thus I bind the fillets of Venus," and then paraded about a prepared altar. An image of clay and one of wax are placed before the same fire. And as the image of clay hardens, so does the heart of Daphnes harden towards his new mistress. And as the figure of wax softens, so is the heart of the ex-lover made tender towards the sorceress. A sacred cake is then broken over the image, and crackling laurels burnt before it. She prays that as the wanton heifer pursues the steer through woods and glens till at length, worn out with fatigue, she lies down on the oozy reeds by the banks of the stream, and the night dew will not even drive her away, so Daphnes may be led on after her forever with inextinguishable love. The relics of his belongings are then buried beneath the threshold. She bruises poisonous herbs of resistless virtue, which had been gathered in the kingdom of Pontus, herbs which enabled him who gave them to turn himself into a hungry wolf prowling amidst the forests, to call up ghosts from the grave, and to translate the ripened harvest from the field where it grew to the lands of another. The ashes of these herbs are cast over her head into the running stream, while she must not look behind her. At length, the sorceress begins to despair and cries, "Daphnes heeds not my incantations, heeds not the gods." She looks again and perceives the ashes on the altar are glowing and emitting sparks of fire. Her faithful house dog barks before the door. "Can these things be?" she exclaims. "Or do lovers dream what they desire?" It is not so. The real Daphnes comes. I hear his steps. He has left the deluding town. He hastens to my longing arms. In the works of Horace, an interesting description of a witch's incantation is also given, the details of which it is instructive to compare with those given by other writers. Four sorceresses are assembled in conclave, the chief being Canidia, with three assistants, in order to work a charm by means of which a youth named Varus, for whom Canidia had conceived a passion, may be compelled to reciprocate her affections. Canidia, with the locks of her disheveled hair twined round with venomous and deadly serpents, orders the wild fig tree and the funeral cypress to be rooted up from the sepulchres on which they grew, and these, together with the egg of a toad smeared with blood, the plumage of the screech owl, various herbs brought from Thessaly in Georgia, and bones torn from the jaws of a famished dog to be burnt in flames, fed with perfumes from Colchis. One assistant, whose hair stands stiff and erect like the quills of the sea hedgehog, or the bristles of a hunted boar, sprinkles the ground with drops from the Avernus, while another, who is reputed to have had the faculty of conjuring the stars and moon down from heaven, assists in other ways. The fourth witch is busy digging a hole with a spade, in which is to be plunged up to his chin the beardless youth stripped of his purple robe, the emblem of his noble descent, and naked, that from his marrow already dry, and his liver, when at length his eyeballs long fixed on the still renovated food which is withheld from his famished jaws, have no longer the power to discern, may be concreted the love potion from which the witches promise themselves the most wonderful results. Canidia, unmoved by his sufferings, works herself into a great rage, and calls upon the night and the morn to help in her infamous incantation. But her victim manages to evade destruction by means of some magical antidote. She then resolves to prepare a still more powerful charm, exclaiming, "Sooner shall the sky be swallowed up in the sea, and the earth be stretched a covering over both, then thou, my enemy, shalt not be wrapped in the flames of love as subtle and tenacious as those of burning pitch." Chapter 4. The Fathers of Medicine. Asclepius, Hippocrates, Diocles, Praxagoras, Chrysippus, Herphilus, Erisistratus, Serapion, Asclepides, Galen. His system of treatment. Medical practice in the 5th century. Alexander of Tralles. The fees of the Roman practitioners. Votive offerings for health. Roman donaria. Roman temples of healing. Though Asclepius is said to have lived so near to the time of the Trojan War, yet the Greeks knew very little about him. The superstition of the time gave him a position among the gods, and as he was adored under the character of the genius of physic, it came at last to be doubted whether he was ever a mortal. Consequently, his priests were obliged for their own sakes to make themselves masters of all the physic that the master could teach, that they might be qualified to give advice to those who applied to them. Their prescriptions passed for the suggestions of the gods, the cures for the miraculous. But both diseases and remedies were carefully recorded. Strabo tells us that from those registers in the temple of Asclepius at Cos, Hippocrates formed his plan for a proper diet. Hippocrates, the wise physician and father of medicine, was, according to Soranus, the son of Heraclides and Phaneretes, descending from Hercules and Asclepius. He was a Coan by birth, and was first instructed by his father, and then by Herodicus and Democritus of Abdua, the philosopher. He flourished at the time of the Peloponnesian War, and after being instructed in physic and the arts, left his own country for Thessaly, where his fame soon became known, even as far as Persia. He was sent for by Perdiccas, king of Macedonia, who was then thought to be consumptive, but Hippocrates diagnosed it to be a disease of the mind and soon cured the king. He is also said to have delivered his own country from a war with the Athenians by prevailing upon the Thessalians to come to their assistance, for which he received great honors from the Coans. He taught his art with great candor and liberality to those who were desirous to learn, and at length died full of honors, it is said, in his 90th year, and was buried between Girton and Larissa. A quaint old tradition states that at his tomb a swarm of bees settled and made their honey for a long time, with which children troubled with aphthous, anointed by their nurses at the grave, were easily cured. He was by no means covetous of money, but grave in his behavior and a lover of Greece, as appears from his curing those of that nation with the utmost diligence, and freeing many of their cities from the plague, for which he acquired great honors. At first, the art of healing was accounted a branch of philosophy, so that the cure of diseases and the study of nature owed their rise to the same persons. Among the many philosophers skilled in the art of the most celebrated were Pythagoras, Empedocles, Democritus, and Hippocrates of Cos. After them came Diocles, the Charistian, Praxagoras, and Chrysippus, with Herphilus and Erisistratus, many of whom practiced their art in entirely different ways. At this period, physic was divided into three schools: the first cured by diet, the second by medicines, the third by manual operations. Those who treated by dietetic methods endeavored to extend their views farther with the assistance of natural philosophy. Then came Serapion, the apostle of practice and experience, and afterwards Asclepiades, who worked a revolution in medical science as then practiced. The knowledge of both surgery and medicine, even in the time of Celsus, is very remarkable, and many of the forms of administration of medicine are employed at the present day. The enema was largely used by the ancients, a common one being hydromel, described by Dioscorides as being made by mixing two parts of water to one of honey. Seawater was also employed for the same purpose, and Celsus recommends the copious drinking of hot water as a laxative remedy. Asclepiades was the originator of massage and friction, and in his book of general remedies describes his treatment, which is similar to that performed today. Poultices of meal of various descriptions were commonly employed, linseed or fenugreek being the favorite media. Asclepiades studied in Alexandria, and after practicing in Greece and Asia Minor, finally settled in Rome in the early part of the 1st century BC. Here he soon met with success and established a reputation for great skill. He was the physician and friend of Cicero, and probably also the instructor of Lucretius in the Epicurean philosophy, of which he was an enthusiastic advocate. He believed the body to be composed of atoms or particles with spaces between, through which, like a sieve, various atoms or of other shapes were continually passing in and out of the body. In practice, he believed in curing his patients with as little discomfort as possible, which doubtless helped to make him popular. He was averse to the employment of violent remedies and the excessive use of emetics and purgatives, so much favored by his fellow practitioners. He advocated the use of music as a soothing agent and was strongly in favor of bathing frequently and of massage. He strongly believed in wine as a remedial agent, which it has been said may have accounted for his popularity with the Roman ladies, with whom as a physician he was in great demand. He lived to a very advanced age and died, it is stated, from the effects of a fall. Galen, born in Pergamus in the year AD 131, studied in the school of Alexandria, which then had a considerable reputation, and there he formulated his system of treatment founded on his knowledge of anatomy and on observation. His fame having spread abroad, he traveled to Rome and became physician to the emperor Marcus Aurelius. According to Galen, the health of the body depended on an equal and uniform mixture of solids and liquids. and its sickness arose from their inequality. Consequently, the physician should foresee illness. He was a profound student of anatomy in his early career, and afterwards turned his attention to physiology. His views as to inflammation, intermittent fevers, and his system of antipathies and sympathies placed him very much above his predecessors. In the beginning of the 5th century, says Lacroix, the practice of medicine, like that of surgery, which has not yet a distinctive branch, continued to be free without any authorization being required. There were even women who, like the druidesses of the Gauls, treated the sick. Charmers, unconscious, no doubt, of the occult forces which they set to work, attempted to cure neurologic pains. Country bone setters to mend fractured limbs, while oculists and impostors of the worst kind traveled the country. It was not until the close of the 8th century that a regular course of medical instruction was founded, the first of the kind being organized at Salerno in the Kingdom of Naples. Alexander of Tralles, a noted physician, flourished in the middle of the 6th century. No Greek doctor equaled him since the days of Hippocrates in regard to his knowledge of art in those primitive days. He is said to have possessed to a high degree the art of diagnosis, and he laid down as a principle that no decision should be arrived at as to the treatment of a case until a specific cause of disease had been carefully considered. His depreciation of violent appearance, his views on melancholia and gout, and his generally common-sense treatment stamped him as a man of superior attainments and ability. He was the first to resort to bleeding from the jugular vein and to use iron in certain diseases affecting the blood. It must not be imagined that the Roman practitioners of medicine were ill-paid, for it is recorded that Stertimus made some 6,500 a year, and Caney, a surgeon, is said to have received 2,000 for one operation, which contrasts well with fees of modern times. Votive offerings for health to the Roman deities were frequent, and sometimes consisted of land, animals, coin, jewelry, and other articles. Other bribes, which have been discovered near ancient shrines, are terracotta figures of deities, human beings, animals, and also portions of human anatomy, such as the liver or stomach. This superstition still exists and is practiced in many parts of Italy, the peasants making votive offerings similar to those of 2,000 years ago. The object of offering models of various portions of the body to special deities was doubtless to propitiate the god to heal that special part, in which the patient believed his complaint originated. This custom of making offerings to the gods, called donaria by the Romans, originated at a very early period. They often took the form of land, buildings, cattle, tools of trade, jewelry, and cast-off clothes. Thus, the Temple of Artemis, Brauronia, was filled with women's clothing. In the temples of the healing gods, instruments of surgery, pharmaceutical appliances, painted tablets representing miraculous healings, and great numbers of models of various parts of the human frame, composed of metal, stone, and terracotta, were deposited. Many of these ancient temples of healing were magnificent buildings with richly decorated interiors, while others were simply shrines or grottos at the source of some hot spring of mineral water, where hundreds of those afflicted with various ailments flocked to bathe or drink the water. The priests in charge regulated the use of the waters and prescribed for the patients. After completing the course, it was customary for the patient to throw an offering into the water, in the form of a silver cup, a coin, or some terracotta model of a limb, and then drag himself off muttering a prayer. Others would hang their gifts on the walls or deposit them at the feet of the statues of the gods placed around. Magnificent offerings, such as goblets of valuable metal with votive inscriptions, have been occasionally found, and other ornaments of gold and silver. It is said, however, that donaria of precious metals were after a time melted down and disposed of by the priests. Grateful patients or surgeons sometimes offered surgical instruments as a thanksgiving for a successful surgical operation. Thus, it is stated, Erostratus offered to Apollo in the Temple of Delphus a forceps of lead to show how little he approved of the fingers as a medium for extracting teeth. Doctors Sambon, Allaire, and others who have discovered a large number of donaria of the Etruscan and Roman period found among the pottery, invalid feeding cups and feeding bottles for infants. Many of the latter were modeled in the form of the female breasts, and others in the shape of animals. These articles were often placed in the tombs of young children who had died in babyhood, instead of the dishes of various foods which were deposited in the tombs of adults. Among other donaria discovered are models of the limbs and viscera of the human body in clay, showing upon them the marks of the various diseases from which the votaries had suffered. Thus, the ancient temples must have presented a curious appearance, festooned on walls and ceilings with these numerous models, all of which told a tale of human suffering. Chapter 5. The Early Age of Greek and Roman Pharmacy. Celsus, Roman Pharmacy, Methods of Administration, Antidotes, Grecian Remedy for Hydrophobia, Chemical Bodies and Drugs Employed by the Greeks and Romans, Dioscorides, his work on Materia Medica, Ancient Method of Collecting Opium, Preparation of Wool Fat, Drugs Used in Pompeii and Herculaneum. Rome, at an early period, gave birth to several philosophers and practitioners in the art of healing. Cornelius Celsus, who is thought to have been a Roman, was a much esteemed writer of their time, and his works on medicine show the advanced state of surgery and medicine during the Roman Empire. His work on medicine gives a considerable insight into the pharmacy of the Romans in his day. With reference to their weights, he says, "I would have it understood that in an ounce is contained the weight of 7 denarii. Next, that I divide each denarius into 6 parts, that is, sectants, so that I have the same quantity in the sectants of a denarius that the Greeks have in their obolus." Of the methods of administration employed in early Roman pharmacy, the melagma was commonly used. It was a kind of soft mass composed of herbs and grass beaten up to the consistency of a thick paste and applied to the skin. Numerous formulae for melagmas are given, in which pellitory, myrrh, resin, cardamoms, ammoniacum, galbanum, etc. are included. Their melagmas correspond with our ointments. They also used plasters, of which the basilicon of galbanum, pitch, resin, and oil in an improved form has survived 2,000 years. Troches for healing wounds were composed of dry medicines held in suspension by some liquid such as wine or oil. Pessaries, vaginal, were originated by the Greeks, who called them pessi. The ingredients were placed in a piece of wool and thus used. Powders and snuffs were also common methods of administration. Antidotes for bruises, bites, and poisons were regarded as extremely important. One was called ambrosia, which Zopyrus is said to have compounded for the King Ptolemy. Another was the celebrated antidote of King Mithridates. The Greeks called their embrocations or ointments ukristia. The katapotia was the method used for internal administration in liquid form, for which many recipes are given by Celsus. The following will serve as an example. Athenio's katapotia for a cough: myrrh, pepper each, castor, poppy tears each, which are bruised separately and afterwards mixed. For venomous bites, the treatment of the ancients, if the wound was severe, was first cupping, or if slight, the plaster of Diogenes was applied, or a salt fish bound over the wound. A curious remedy practiced by the Greeks for hydrophobia was to throw the patient suddenly into a pond, and if he could not swim, let him sink several times and thus drink. If he can swim, keep him down at times until he may be satiated with water. For thus at once, writes Celsus, is both the thirst and the dread of water removed. Their antidote for nearly all poisons was warm oil, given in order to induce vomiting. The word collyrium, now applied to a lotion for the eyes, was also used by the ancients. But they gave it a greater latitude and also employed it to describe a composition of powders wrought to a pasty consistence with a liquid, and formed into something like a tent for insertion into cavities. Of the chemical bodies and drugs known both to the Greeks and the Romans, the number is not a few. Cinnabar, which seems to have been known from a very remote period, was the name applied to the red sulfide of mercury, and also to dragon's blood. It is doubtless of the latter, Pliny says, he believed to be the gore of a dragon crushed by the weight of a dying elephant, with a mixture of the blood of these animals. Copperas, lead, alum, copper, and iron were used as styptics. Myrrh, frankincense, cardamoms, linseed, isinglass, and cobwebs were used as astringents. Galbanum, storax, bitumen are recommended for promoting suppuration, while pennyroyal, sulfur, pellitory, staves, acre, oxgall, scimony, rue, and opium were all included in their medical recipes. Dioscorides was the first to attempt to record in anything like a methodical manner the many drugs and chemical substances used by the early Greeks. Petesion, Dioscorides, born in Anazaba in Sicily, was a Greek physician who lived in or about the 2nd century. He gathered a great portion of his information on Materia Medica during his travels with the Roman army, which he accompanied on several expeditions in the capacity of physician. Afterwards, he wrote his great work, Perihul's Latrix, about Materia Medica, which for 15 centuries or more remained one of the chief authorities on that science. It treats of all medicines then in use, with their preparations and action as then known. The work of this early physician first appeared in a Latin translation in 1478, the first Greek edition being published in 1499. The work afterwards was translated into Spanish, Italian, French, German, and Arabic. In describing the papaver sativum and its virtues in this work, he says, "It is not improper to subjoin the method in which the opus or juice of it is collected. Some then cutting the poppy heads with the leaves, squeeze them through a press, and rubbing them in a mortar, form them into troches. This is called mesonium, and is weaker than the opus. But whoever desires to gather the juice must proceed thus. After the heads are moistened with dew, let him cut round the asterisk with a knife, but not penetrate through them, and from the sides cut straight lines in the surface, and draw off the tear that flows with his finger into a shell. And come again not long after, for it will be found standing upon it, and the day following it will be found in the same manner. Hence the old name, poppy tears." Dioscorides was also learned in the preparation of wool fat, which he calls oesipum, known to modern pharmacists as lanoline. He says, "Oesipum is the oily part collected from sordid wool. Thus, the wool was washed in warm water and all its sordides expressed. The fat floated with a froth, and upon throwing in some seawater, it subsided. And when all the oesipum was obtained from it in this manner, it was purified by repeated effusions of water. When pure, it had no sharp taste, and was in some degree astringent and appeared white, and was emollient and filled up ulcers. Recent excavations made at Pompeii and Herculaneum have thrown some further light on the various articles of Materia Medica as it existed in the days just preceding the destruction of those cities. Aloe seems to have been held in high esteem by the practitioners of the time, and was employed, we learn from the historian, in 29 diseases. It was prescribed in doses from 1 to 111 drachmas, about 68 grains, and mixed with wine, was employed to stimulate the growth of the hair. Aconite, we find, was used in 4 diseases and was supposed to be an antidote to any poison which might exist in the system. Other remedies mentioned include gum acacia, colocynth, eleutherium, gold, silver, copper, and elecampane. It is further recorded of the latter drug that Julia Augusta, daughter of Augustus Caesar, used to eat the root daily. Of the vegetable remedies, about 150 are enumerated, and of these, the cabbage seems to have held a prominent place. Other favorite medicines were rye, garlic, anise, mallow, rose, and lily. In the animal kingdom, the remedies contributed were numerous, being mainly the various parts of man and beast. Among some of the least disgusting, hair, blood, and saliva may be mentioned. Scrapings from the bodies of athletes mixed with the oil with which they anointed themselves were used as a tonic. The hair of a man torn from the cross was used as a remedy for quartan fever. The hyena was employed as a medicinal agent in 79 diseases. And the crocodile, chameleon, lion, elephant, camel, and the hippopotamus were all contributed to certain curative agents. Wolf fat was held in great esteem. Of minerals, iron, lead, nitrum, salt, gold, tin, silver, realgar, copper, and mizi, a combination of the sulfates of copper and iron, are enumerated. Most of these articles are mentioned by the second Pliny, who was killed during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, which buried Pompeii. Chapter 6. Alchemy. The Alchemists. The word chemistry was used for the first time by Suidas, lexicographer of the 10th century, and at that time meant an alloy of gold and silver. It is alluded to in connection with the emperor Diocletian, of whom it is said that, irritated by a revolt of the Egyptians against the laws of the empire, he had all their books of chemistry committed to the flames, so as to punish them for their rebellion by preventing them from carrying on the lucrative business arising out of the melting and working of precious metals. There's little doubt the Egyptians and Greeks were acquainted with certain chemical operations, or what was termed the Hermetic science, which was afterwards called alchemy in the first century of the Christian era. The first two great lights that appeared were Alcindus and Geber, who discovered the red oxide and bichloride of mercury, nitric acid, hydrochloric acid, and nitrate of silver. Geber's Summa Perfectionis and Liber Philosophorum embody his researches on the purification and malleability of metals. In the 9th century, the Arab alchemist Rhazes flourishes. In his great work entitled El Harvi, he alludes to realgar, orpiment, borax, mixtures of sulfur and iron with copper, and of mercury with acids and arsenic. He further recommends physicians to use alcoholic preparations and animal oils, etc. He states, "The secret art of chemistry is nearer possible than impossible. The mysteries do not reveal themselves except by force of labor and perseverance. But what a triumph it is when man can raise a corner of the veil which conceals the works of God." The knowledge displayed of chemistry and its application to the arts at that early period is wonderful, but books were few. The chief evidence of this knowledge is exhibited in the many specimens and art monuments in the museums of Spain, showing the skill of the Saracens and of the Moors. A little later, Massieu states, "Certain principles had been recognized as to the analytical classification of the bodies which compose organic matter." Of the ancient necromancers who have figured in history and romance, Merlin was perhaps the most extraordinary. The earliest mention of his name is in records of the 11th century, although he appears to have flourished about the time of the Saxon invasion of Britain in the latter part of the 5th century. He is first mentioned in connection with the fortune of Vortigern, who is represented by Geoffrey of Monmouth as at that time King of England. Vortigern, having lost all his strongholds in the struggle with the Saxons, at length consulted his magicians as to how he was to defend himself from his troublesome foe. They advised him to build an impregnable tower, and chose a suitable site for its erection. The builders set to work with might and main, but were astonished to find that as fast as they built in one day, The next morning, the earth had swallowed it up, and not a vestige remained. So the king called the wise men together again when they arrived at the conclusion that the only way to remedy the matter was to cement the walls of the tower with the blood of a human being, who was born of no human father. Vortigern at once sent forth emissaries to scour the country in search of this rara avis, and at length, by good fortune, they came across Merlin, near the town of Caermarthen in Wales, who claimed that his mother was the daughter of a king, but his father was an angelic being. The king's emissaries evidently took his word for it, as they speedily carried him before Vortigern. A great meeting of the magicians was called, at which the king presided, and Merlin, instead of being condemned as the victim, confounded the wise men, and told the king the ground they had chosen for his tower had a lake beneath it, at the bottom of which, on being drained, they would find two dragons of inextinguishable hostility. Under the form of dragons, he appears to have figured the Britons and Saxons in his speech, all of which, the historian tells us, proved to be true. But the greatest exploit with which Merlin is credited, according to tradition, is the erection of Stonehenge as the lasting monument to the 300 British nobles massacred by the Saxons. It is supposed that these mighty stones had been originally set up in Africa, and from thence were transported to Ireland. Merlin commanded that they should be carried over the sea and erected on Salisbury Plain, but no workmen could be found to move them. He therefore brought his magical power to bear on the huge stones, and by this means they were caused to take the form in which they now stand. Of the other wonderful stories which romance has woven round the career of this strange individual, we can only say that they are interesting if not exactly true. As 600 years elapsed between the time of Merlin and the earliest known records of his achievements, it is impossible to pronounce on their veracity. Among the more famous of the early alchemists was Saint Dunstan, who flourished in the 10th century. But if tradition speaks truly, he was anything but a saint in character. He is said to have been a man of distinguished birth, who in his young days lived a life of great self-indulgence, even for that period of peculiar morality. At length, he was seized with a dangerous illness which threatened to terminate his career. But at the last extremity, an angel appeared, bringing a medicine which speedily restored him to health. Hastening to the nearest church to return thanks, he was stopped by the devil with a pack of black dogs, whom, however, he speedily put to flight. In order to expiate his former irregularities, he now secluded himself in the Abbey of Glastonbury, where he occupied a cell in which he could neither stand upright nor stretch his limbs in repose, and mortified his flesh exceedingly. Here he studied alchemy and magic, in which arts he soon became well versed. While in this cell, he is said to have had the most extraordinary visitations. And among others, the devil was constantly thrusting his head in at the window and taunting the saint, while immersed in his studies. At length, one day, wearied out, Dunstan lost all patience, and seizing his red-hot tongs from the little furnace in which he conducted his chemical operations, caught the devil by the nose and held him firmly, while the bellowings of Satan, says the historian, filled the whole neighborhood for many miles around. This incident is frequently represented in ancient carvings. Dunstan was a Benedictine monk, and next came forth and took a prominent part in political and religious matters. He seems to have been the kingmaker of his time and took a prominent part in the ruling of the kingdom during the reigns of Edwy and Edgar. In the accompanying illustration, the alchemist, with uplifted torch, is repeating the specified incantation over the still, under which he has just kindled a fire, having commenced the preparation of the elixir of life. In the year AD 1260, Albertus Magnus, formerly a Dominican monk, was made master of the sacred palace at the court of Rome, and afterwards bishop of Ratisbon. This great philosophical student was learned in all the then-known arts of chemistry, and his manuscripts and works were copied by the thousand. All kinds of extraordinary powers were attributed to him, and it was commonly stated that he could make gold and that he was a magician. Accused of Having dealings with the evil one, he resigned his high position and returned to his cloistered cell to carry on his favorite researches and end his days. Next, we come to Vincent de Beauvais, often called the Pliny of the Middle Ages. He, too, was accused of sorcery, and it is said that at midnight people would creep along the quays of the Seine towards his laboratory in Saint-Chapelle Yard, to see if they could get a glimpse reflected in the river of the magic furnaces in which de Beauvais was supposed to evoke his familiar spirit. About the same time, Raymond Lully became known to fame. He also was a monk and born in the island of Majorca. But having a roving disposition, he wandered over Europe. He wrote several works on alchemy, among others, Le Billy, Aliquot, Chemisy, etc. Fabulous stories are related of his adventures, and he was cruelly stoned to death by the populace in Tunis in 1315. He left behind him a following of believers who called themselves Lullists and spread all over Europe. The genius of the West at this time was Arnold de Villeneuve, who made several important discoveries in chemistry. His researches were particularly directed to the relation of chemistry to medicine. He is credited with having discovered sulfuric and other acids and is said to have been the first to distill alcohol or spirit of wine. Contemporary with these men of learning was our own Roger Bacon, whose love for his art nearly cost him his life, besides many years in prison. The discoverer of gunpowder and the telescope spent most of his life in experimental researches, with the result that he revolutionized the art of war and gave to astronomers the power of exploring the heavens. He was a man of great ability, never justly appreciated by his contemporaries, and has been rightly named the father of experimental physics. He described most of the laws which regulate matter and the regular motion of the planets. Although a man of undoubted knowledge and great power of conception, he was bitten with the mania of endeavoring to discover the Philosopher's Stone, his views respecting which he set forth in his work entitled Ridex Mundi. Following Bacon came Antonio Quaner of Pavia, who was the first to manufacture artificial mineral waters. It has been said by some that the discoveries made by the alchemists were mainly the result of chance, and they were mostly ignorant charlatans, but although they had little method in their research and a great deal of their knowledge was wrapped up in absurd and superstitious theories, when we look at the result of their discoveries up to the 15th century, the most prejudiced must admit that their labors were not spent entirely in vain. They demonstrated the existence of bismuth, liver of sulfur, and regulus of antimony, the distillation of alcohol, volatilization of mercury and preparation of aqua regia, sulfuric and other mineral acids, and the purification of alkalis. They had the scarlet dye for cloth, the secret of which has now been lost and cannot be equaled. And their processes of glass staining cannot be approached by those employed at the present day. It is said that Eck, a German alchemist of Sulzbach, ascertained the existence of oxygen 300 years before it was demonstrated by Priestley. For these and other discoveries, we have to thank the early alchemists. During the 15th and 16th centuries, alchemy began to shake itself free from the wild theories and absurd practices which had impeded its progress. Henry VII issued a severe edict against the alchemical practices, which put a stop to the impositions of a number of charlatans. About this period, John Baptist Porta discovered the means of reducing the metallic oxides and of coloring silver, and Isaac and Jean Hollandus made great improvements in enameling and demonstrated the manufacture of artificial gems. From the time of Paracelsus and the introduction of printing, the science received a fresh impetus, and a new order of chemists came into being, whose conflict with the old order for many years is a matter of history. The old theories of the alchemists were gradually exploded and superseded, and many were driven to the most flagrant quackery to earn a living. Cornelius Agrippa, who was one of the leaders of the new order, says, "It would take too much time to recount all the follies, the idle secrets, and the enigmas of this trade, of the green lion, the fugitive stag, the flying eagle, the inflated toad, crow's head of the black, blacker than the black, the seal of Mercury, of the mud of wisdom, and other countless absurdities of the time. Many of them traveled from fair to fair in order to make a little money by the sale of white lead, vermilion, antimony, and other drugs used by women for painting the face. And drugs which the scripture calls ointments of lust. Meanwhile, the efforts of the practical workers were encouraged by administrators and princes, with the result that the application of chemistry and the technical arts became predominant, and metallurgy the leading spirit of the science. A notable character in the time of Queen Elizabeth was Dr. Dee, alchemist and astrologer. The career of this man, who was more a charlatan than aught else, was one of extraordinary vicissitude. A Welshman by birth, he was educated at Oxford and then traveled throughout Europe, claiming that he had discovered the elixir of life and the philosopher's stone. He was a man of overweening ambition and delighted to hear himself called most excellent. In company with a man named Kelly, it is said he discovered a quantity of the elixir in the ruins of Glastonbury Abbey. This they at once annexed and carried off to Poland, accompanied by a nobleman of that country. After traveling from one court to another, where he is said to have performed wonderful feats with his elixir, he returned to England and settled at Mortlake, where Elizabeth often visited him to consult him on astrology, and he even ventured to predict her death. He was a great favorite at court in 1595, and the Queen made him Chancellor of Paul's and Warden of Manchester, but he died in great poverty. The illustration represents an alchemist of the 16th century in an anteroom of his laboratory, engaging in fixing a portion of his apparatus. On the table is his looting box and knife. Through one window, a view of the laboratory with stills of varied size is obtained, while through the other, the sun looks with becoming gravity on the operation. The symbols of the alchemists. As in modern science, chemists write their formula and work out their processes by means of symbols. So the alchemists used signs and hieroglyphics to represent the then known elements, metals, and other articles in common use. The so-called elements, fire, air, water, earth, were represented by special symbols here represented. The metals were supposed to be influenced by the planets to a certain degree and were represented by their corresponding signs. Various other articles also had their symbols, which served as a means of shorthand at a period when calligraphy was little known or employed. These are the symbols referenced: fire, air, water, two types, earth, lead, tin, iron, gold, copper, mercury, silver, antimony, arsenic, aqua vitae, borax, two types, to purify, cinnabar, caput mortuum, an oil, salpetre, a magnet, sal ammoniac, sulfur, tartar, covered pot, to sublime, to precipitate, spirit of wine, Roman symbol for denarius, to digest, to distill, aqua fortis, aqua regulis, brick, to calcine, camphor, ashes, ceruse, lime, quicklime, cinnabar, wax, hartshorn, a crucible, three different, crystal, a gum, oil, three different, steel filings, litharge, to lute, sublimated mercury, precipitated mercury, nitre, real gar, three types, sand, soap, sal alkali, sal ammoniac, salt, talc, vinegar, verdigris, vitriol, urine, day and night. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.